Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Rachel Stewart, and I am a PhD student at the University of Kent. And this is a recording for the Sex, Sexualities and Sex Work special series. Today, IU Saraswati has come to talk to us about her book, The Pain Generation. Can you tell us who you are and what your area of expertise is, please?
Absolutely. First of all, thank you so much for having me today and allowing me to share my work with you. It's such an honor. I've listened to your podcast, so it's really, really exciting to be here today. So I am IU Saraswati, currently an associate professor and chair at the Department of Women's Studies at the University of Hawaii in Manoa. And my research revolves around gender, race, and media, and the new media. And that is the book that we'll be talking about today.
Excellent, excellent. So what prompted you to write the book? And I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed the book. I really, really enjoyed the book. Like it crossed with a lot of my areas of interest and I got a lot from it. So what prompted the book?
Yeah, thank you so much. And in the coda or at the end of the book, I talk a tiny bit about why I wrote this book. So I'm sure you're kind of like, you know, familiar with how the social media is kind of like endless self-promotion about, oh, look at me, I'm doing this, I'm traveling here, you know, all of that, right? And so it was fun, obviously, in the beginning, it was fun. And if you think about it, Instagram was only established around 2010, right? And so this has only been around for like 11 years. So everything new in the beginning is exciting and, you know, we just want to be a part of it and it's lots of images. And so it was exciting. And then when you look at it from in terms of like a travel blogger perspective, it is, you know, or like when they share that pictures is really, really lovely and inspiring. And I use, you know, my air quote here, inspiring. But then I kind of, you know, and then I learned that I too do that. And then my friends who are feminists or academics and all of that, we begin to do that. But then at the time, I wasn't aware of what's happening, right? Obviously, after I wrote the book and then recognizing that I also performed this thing that I called the neoliberal selfie gaze in my book, now it becomes clear of what was happening, right? But at the time, when things were happening, I wasn't really sure like what was going on, but I just found it like a little bit problematic. Like, you know, like when you feel when you saw a posting and you're kind of like, something is wrong here, but I'm not quite sure what happened, right? And so I think that was what kind of like prompted me to like write this book. I was like, okay, so something is a bit, you know, troubling, kind of like annoying about how we kind of promote ourselves endlessly on this platform. Again, including myself. So I'm not criticizing other people here. Maybe I'm just criticizing myself. And then the same thing. So that's one thing, right? This sort of like endless self-promotion and all that kind of stuff wanted me to take a deeper look or, you know, kind of like a closer look at like what's going on here. So that's one. The other thing too is about how we share our emotions or things that happen to us again, endlessly on social media, you know, Facebook and all of that. Again, I'm talking about myself here. So, you know, if you feel defensive, yo, you know, I'm talking about myself here, you know, as well. Because in person, I tend to be kind of, you know, especially in a group setting or whatnot, I tend to be the quiet one. I tend to be shy. I even have that nickname. So I was growing up. But then on social media, I would just share things like, well, this happened to me or this happened to me, right? And things that provoke emotions in myself and other people, right? And so again, I was like, well, let's take a look here. Like, what is going on? What's going on? And so I wanted to look at how we process emotions, right? And in my first book, I talk about race and gender and how race is affectively constructed. And I use the word affect here, you know, drawing from affect theory. And maybe for some of the listeners who may not be familiar, but affect is, there are like many, many different definitions of it. But the one that I use in my first book was from Teresa Brennan. And she talks about affect as physiological shift that accompanies judgment, right? So this means that when we feel embarrassed, when someone says something, and then we can feel our cheek is like kind of like warm, right? So that's the physiological shift. Or when we look at someone so beautiful and something is happening in our body, like, oh, what's happening, right? And so that's the affect, right? And so in my first book, I talk about how race is affectively constructed. What that means is that when we see a person of a certain race and of a certain gender, there's something in our body that effectively responds to that image, right? Or to that person that we encounter. So that's in my first book. So in my second book, I'm still, again, fascinated or indebted to affect theory, but in a way that, you know, how do we process our emotions, right? In other words, how do we experience and express our emotions on social media differently than otherwise we would in real life. So that is the other part of like why I wanted to write this book.
Yeah. And that fits really well into my first question, because there are loads of phrases in here that just totally just like sort of like piqued my, you know, sort of like really piqued my interest. And one of the phrases that I was going to ask you about, and which you've mentioned, is the neoliberal selfie gaze. So I wondered if you could talk us through how the book discusses that idea, the neoliberal selfie gaze.
Absolutely. So the main argument of the book is how neoliberal logic shapes and limits, right, our feminist activism on these platforms, on social media, right? And so I wanted to kind of like have a language to talk about, you know, like, what do I mean by this, right? And so in one of my first chapters, so chapter two, I talk about Rupi Kaur, an amazing Canadian poet, and she's very, you know, very famous, very popular. And I too really, I follow her Instagram account. This is an amazing, amazing work, right? And so in my kind of like talking about or like providing example to like what neoliberal selfie gaze is, I kind of like give an example of an acai bowl, like, let's say, right? When we want to post something on our social media, let's say breakfast, and I just mentioned like an acai bowl. If we want to post this on our Instagram account, we need to make it very interesting, right? Very entertaining, so that people will click on that, people will want to follow us, right? So let's say if you just post a bowl of, you know, fruit, acai bowl or whatever that is on the table without background, without the gorgeous beach, you know, like in Hawaii background, right? Or use the filter, right, to make the color of the fruit like pop up, or without the caption, right, that is funny or entertaining about this, you know, what we're eating, then it would not be as interesting or entertaining, right? And so what I'm talking about here, therefore, is what I call the creation of, you know, phantasmagoria, or like social media as phantasmagoria, which is, you know, how do we create this? Again, I'm using the word affect here, creating the affective atmosphere, right? So that we're kind of like, you know, interested in that. We really, really like this image. Like it provokes something affectively in us, right? In order to do that, we have to do all these things, right? And Rupikaur is amazing in doing that. First of all, on her Instagram account, I talk about this in my book, is that she would alternate between image and her poem, another image and poem, right? And not only that, the image of that she includes is very what I call from the neoliberal selfie gaze, which is, you know, positioning the self as, you know, entertaining, as inspiring, right? As smart, right? So that's kind of like the idea of a good neoliberal subject is, yeah. It's like you take personal responsibility of like making yourself, you know, look good or be better, you know, those kind of stuff, right? And so in her case, she has this amazing poem in itself, but then she would have a sketch, right? So it has a white background, and then there's the poem, but also she would like have like this sketch that some people may call like childlike sketches, right? And so, and not only that, then it's followed or alternate by images. And these images many, many times show image of herself, sometimes in Vancouver, you know, like, and, you know, places around the world, right? That shows that she's this, you know, cosmopolitan, glamorous, you know, very, again, this powerful woman, yeah. Right? And so that really creates that contrast from this sort of a poem about pain or about abuse in a relationship or whatnot, right? But then you follow that instead with, you know, not images of like blood or something or like heartbreak or something like that, but of this strong, powerful woman, right? So that again creates that shock, that creates what I call that phantasmagoria, right? That creates like, you know, that invites people or provokes emotions or affect in people's body. And so that's what I mean by the neoliberal selfie gaze, right? It's a gaze, it's a way of seeing, it's a way of storifying the self, right? And I use that word, storifying the self, so that when we see that, or when we read that, we become entertained and inspired by it, right? Another example, just so that, you know, the listeners may have better ideas, is that when someone posts that they just had a divorce or they just had like a, you know, a breakup or something. If they just like, oh my God, my life sucks, blah, 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 right? Then it's not entertaining. It's not from that neoliberal selfie gaze, right? Yeah. Because again, neoliberal subject means that you have to, you know, post something that is, okay, this happens, breakup happens, divorce happens, but I'm going to like, you know, come out of this, you know, better than I was before, right? And all of those very inspirational sort of quotes even, right? So I had to laugh that at one of my conversations with my colleagues, he was mentioning that, you know, I don't look at my Facebook anymore, he said, because everybody turns into a Dalai Lama, he said. So I was like, oh yeah, that's, you know, that's actually perfect, right? He notices that. And so what I'm doing here is to name that and simultaneously trouble that. And so I name that phenomena by that concept, neoliberal selfie gaze.
Yeah, but also as well, sort of like, so my understanding of neoliberalism is that that is a kind of like this totally entrepreneurial sort of like, absolutely, social actor who never needs any like real community support or anything like that. It doesn't need any sort of social security or anything like that. You know, out of the ashes of their divorce, they will pick themselves up and create a whole new like side hustle. Yeah, they won't just get divorced, they'll become a divorce guru. Yeah, and that's kind of what we do, isn't it? I mean, but also as well, it's, and I don't know if you do this, but I have certain times during the year when I know that I'm going to engage with social media. Mm-hmm. When I know that's coming, the month before, I will drop out because mm-hmm. I like to be sort of like new and exciting. Like I'm very aware, and I don't know if you are, of like sort of like that kind of like digital exhaustion that we almost suffer, you know, because there's a fine line, isn't there, between somebody who's really playing their digital media well and overexposing themselves.
Absolutely, absolutely. But even this, what you're saying too, right? This sort of strategically, right? I mean, you have this sort of like strategies of like how to manage your media presence or like your social media presence as well. I mean, in some ways, again, depending on like why you're doing that, right? But if a person is doing that so that, you know, when they post something, it becomes new and exciting for the audience, right? So that, you know, when they drop something, they say, then it becomes like a hit or something like that. Then that in itself is an example of a neoliberal selfie gay, yeah. Right? That they, like you said, is this very entrepreneurial sort of like subjectivity. They know how to kind of target the market. They know how to connect this thing with that thing, right? But again, like you said, this becomes that sort of like individual sort of enterprise, right? They do this. They have to be aware of this. They market their own things, their own books. Again, you know, I do that. I'm guilty of that. But I'm saying that rather redundantly, right? In some ways, keep mentioning that I do this, I do that, because I do want the listeners or the readers to realize or not feel as defensive when they read this, because you know what? This is so pervasive.
Yeah.
Right. I do this too. Like I internalize this and I post this on social media. And as I was writing this book, I was like, oh no, I'm doing this and I'm doing this a lot. I mean, this is why I kind of like, okay, well, thank God I wrote this book, because now I have a better understanding of my own social media practice. And I try to, you know, not successfully, but I try to kind of like minimize that neoliberal selfie gaze.
Because you're in your introduction, you discuss the danger of feminist activists using technological apparatus and digital platforms that are governed by neoliberal logic. What do you mean by that? How does this book discuss these dangers that are presented to like sort of feminist activists?
Yeah, so absolutely. So the first three analytical chapters, I talk about Rupi Kaur, I talk about Mia Matsumiya, and I talk about Margaret Cho. And as an example, I'm just going to use a different example, the 12 Days of Rage, which is a hashtag campaign that Margaret Cho started. And again, Margaret Cho, love her. Anytime I find myself in the same city as her, I will always try to go to her show. I thought she was brilliant. And then actually I heard about the 12 Days of Rage campaign when I went to one of her shows and I looked it up and I was like, oh, okay. So I really want to know more about this. And the 12 Days of Rage is her campaign to end sexual violence, right? Sexual violence, sexual abuse, sexual harassment. So in itself is what we do as, you know, feminist activists. This is, you know, a great endeavor, right? And she took it to Twitter, not only to Twitter. I mean, she posts videos on YouTube, right? So it's kind of like a social media campaign. Now, the problem with that, and I talk more about it in the book, is that when we have a celebrity talk about it, when we have this campaign, like social media campaign, more people become aware of it, right? Even with the Me Too movement, we began to see certain actors who got persecuted, right? And so this is a good sort of step. But what I'm saying is that maybe we're missing the next step because this, all of these sort of campaigns are still from that neoliberal selfie gaze in which it is about the self, right? Rather than, or like changing the self, changing the perpetrator's behavior rather than kind of like structural changes. The Me Too movement, and again, I talked just a tiny, tiny bit because my book is not really about Me Too movement. In some ways, it is, but, you know, prior to Me Too hashtag becoming big, or, you know, and especially by Asian American women. I mean, in some ways you can see that this book is about Me Too, but in some ways it isn't, right? But I did talk about even the name Me Too, right? And I talk about how, like, you know, in some ways this is why it resonates with a lot of people or women at the time, because this is talking about me. Right.
Yeah.
Again, me is the most important subject in the neoliberal sort of selfie, you know, gaze or understanding. Right. Because this is about me, 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 me. Right. And so it kind of like, yeah, me too. Obviously, the two tries to highlight that this is a structural issue, structural problem, that this is a collective problem, not just me. But in some ways, what it does so far is it allows certain individual to become the problem, right? Certain men become the problem, but then the structure itself, the corporations itself, yeah, has not changed, right? And so I talk a little bit about that in the book, right? And so, like, when we have celebrities such as Margaret Cho talk about this, yeah, this is great. But at the same time, even this campaign has not asked specifically for what are, like, the structural changes that need to happen, right? Right? Where is that link? Again, if it's just another link, right, to sign to the petition. But even then, at the end of the book, I say, like, this is not enough. If we want to do, we want to have significant changes and structural changes, then what needs to happen is not just on digital media, not on social media, but we need to also bring our bodies, you know, in these different spaces or consider other environments, right? So I think that's some of the problems that I kind of, like, mentioned in my book, is that, you know, we need to be careful that our feminist activism is not being neoliberalized, right? It's not being co-opted by the neoliberal machine of the social media. And it has, right? And so, again, I just want to be clear. And even in the book itself, I, like, repeatedly saying, you know, please know that I'm not criticizing these specific feminists as individuals, right? Because to do that is to do a neoliberal reading of what they're doing. Again, what I'm doing is I analyze the structure, right? But in order for me to provide specific examples, I look at specific individual Instagram account. But in order to expose how the structure manifests on their social media accounts or campaigns.
And it's interesting you say that, because as soon as you say that, instead of Me Too, it should be they do it to us. Yeah, because it should be a much wider discussion. But also as well, like, we have to be really careful that we don't feed into that whole kind of carceral feminism thing that I'm sort of, like, totally obsessed with at the moment. So it's kind of like, and we've seen it with the Me Too, haven't we? It's become a witch hunt of a couple of individuals, when actually there's a much bigger issue that is ignored when we perform these witch hunts. Yeah, so we bring it. So what happens is that the criminal justice system gets brought in, but still maintain, you know, has this appearance of addressing issues, but still maintaining the status quo.
Absolutely. And I think that's their brilliance. I mean, in terms of maintaining how, you know, it seems like things are happening, right? Like, seems like we are protesting, seems like, you know, people are saying, oh, you know, I can't do this anymore, I can't do that anymore. But really, the structure hasn't changed. Yeah. You know, many women still feel uncomfortable, even in, you know, like, office settings, or even in terms of, like, relationships, or even, like, what you talked about, the criminal justice system hasn't changed, right? We haven't really transformed that. And so that's why I think this book is sort of like a call to, you know, let's focus also, right? And I think I also use that word also. I'm not saying that we should not focus on the individual sort of, like, you know, behaviors and whatnot, but we need to also look at the structure, right? I mean, what are, like, some of the changes that need to happen at the structural level? And I think I use the word ecology in my book purposefully, not just sort of like structure, not just sort of like the environment, but, you know, this sort of like the notion of ecology, right? So we need to look at, you know, like, what else needs to happen here? It's not just this one thing, not just individual behavior. For as long as we're stuck there, you know, those who are in power or the patriarchy or all of these sort of like violence will continue to happen, because nothing really at the fundamental, more foundational sort of like level has changed or shifted.
Yeah. So I liked as well in your introduction to, like, literally I went over this introduction about four times. I really enjoyed it. It was like,
oh, thank you so much. Oh,
So you mentioned in the book that corporations sort of co-opting feminist activist ideas to improve corporate branding. Mm. How do you discuss this in the book?
Yeah, so I think this, you know, when we talk about I think one of the things that I talk about was Matt Lauer, but it's just like very, very briefly about like how in the Me Too movement, you know, we talk about how he, you know, obviously was being one of the like the Me Too, like being attacked by the Me Too, right? But in some ways, the NBC itself, right, is not really like we don't really hear anything from the corporation themselves. And in fact, the corporation will now have TV shows, right? And I'm not just talking about like one, but you know, across the board, they have programs that seemingly portray sort of like feminist sort of actors or activism, right? Or like they have those sort of like activities that support, you know, feminism. Or, and this, I don't talk about this in the book, but also even universities. We know that there is Me Too PhD, right? You know, in terms of women or people being sexually harassed in the academic settings. But as we know too, nothing significant has changed, right? In terms of the structure of like, you know, how are we going to report this differently and significantly, you know, like what are the things that are happening? And yet, right? And yet what happens is that we have lots of talks about this. And I talk about like lectures and whatnot, and there are like courses about this, whatever. And so in some ways, again, this is not corporations, but a different example of how this is being commodified. Yeah. Right. And that's, I guess that's what I meant. It's like, it's being commodified or being co-opted, but you know, by shows or by advertisements now that celebrate, you know, feminist activism or classes or lectures, but what is happening? But what is really happening? Or we talk about Black Lives Matter. Again, I do not really talk about that in the book, but I mean, we think about that too, right? You know, we have, you know, different things happening, but have we hired, right, more Black scholars? I mean, like what are, you know, the significant changes that are happening in all of these different environments.
I was thinking as well, what she was saying this about the discussion that Laura Augustine has around the trafficking industry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you can use that kind of sort of same logic when you talk about human trafficking and the massive business, the massive industry that is built up around this, that's brought in increasing legislation, but which is increasingly damaging towards the women it purports to help. So it's almost like we have to be really careful as feminists that we don't actually contribute to the problem that we're trying to highlight. You know, it's that we may be highlighting one focus of, you know, sort of inequality, but, you know, by doing that, that we sort of like set this machine rolling that then we can't stop.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's always hard, I think, to write about these kind of things when we, I don't want to use the word criticize, but I don't know what the word I would want to use, but to highlight, I guess, the problems that are happening because of these things that we do, right? As feminist activists, because obviously prior to going in and doing what we do, we don't know like how, what the effects are. And so I hope this book will be seen as just that, right? For us to kind of just like pause and regroup, right?
Yeah.
It's not to say like, let's stop, let's not do that, let's not do that. But it's just sort of like, okay, well, wait a minute. I think we're doing something that's problematic here. Let's just stop for a minute, right? Because sometimes things that we do and then obviously we mean well, and then it ends up being harming for the women that, you know, I don't want to use we're trying to help because that creates that kind of patronizing kind of like relationship. But it's harmful for women, period. Right.
Yeah.
And so, but I think it's always good to have this kind of conversation to just sort of like, okay, these are why it's problematic. I provide example for this, and maybe, and I come up with like a tiny, tiny suggestion at the end of my book, but maybe you'll come up with like bigger, better ideas out there. So I think that's just sort of like where, you know, I hope my book can kind of like, you know, in that kind of
conversation. I really liked as well, because it was so like there are certain themes that are going through my life this week. Do you have that in your academic life? Like there's the, you know, there'll be themes that are going through. And at the moment I'm writing an article about Zemiology, about social harms. And I was really struck by the amount of social harm that is done by these, you know, by these sort of like neoliberal selfie type campaigns. You know, we have to start thinking about that, don't we? It's almost like we've become so self-absorbed that we need to take a step and see actually what our, you know, the ripple effects of our actions. It's almost like we need to sort of like rewind to a kind of like a community-based thinking rather than self-based thinking.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that is exactly, you got it like right on at the end of the book, that there are like the three C's I talk about, right? I mean, before we post anything on social media, let's think of the content. Is it just about us? Or is it about the community, right? Also, it's about the context. Again, is it about I, or is it about I in the context, right? And then the collective. So like you said, you know, we have to shift this thinking. It's about the collective thinking. It's about us. It's about me. It's about me. It's about me all the time. So I think that's like, you really, really capture that. It's, you know, we have to shift our thinking and, you know, like, how do we do that? And like I said, I only provided this like one idea, which is what you mentioned about, you know, going back to the collective, thinking about the context, right? Thinking about the content itself. But I have to say too, though, you know, in some ways, this book also is a critique to the self-love and self-care culture. Mm-hmm. And especially during the pandemic, I again like read on everybody's social media, don't forget to do self-care, you know, self-love is important during pandemic, right? So I read about that and I was like, oh, you know, because I've been writing about this, and I think the book was actually done by the time pandemic hit, actually. So I was like, okay, so this is exactly what I talk about in my book. But here's the thing. Obviously, as women, right? We are taught to always put other people first, right? Give your food to your partner, to your kids, to other people, right? You know, take care of the house, take care of this, you know, like all of that, right? So we were taught not to love ourselves. So obviously, you know, feminists wanted to rebel, you know, we want to rebel against that idea, and we want to reclaim, we have to love ourselves first. We have to put ourselves first, right? And so that makes sense, right? That's why it's so seductive for us, you know, feminists, to reclaim that and say self-love, you know, all of that. And I must admit that, you know, every year, me and my colleague, we have this annual writing and meditation retreat for women in academia, right? And so even in that retreat, in the beginning of that retreat, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, I would actually use neoliberal sort of like ideas, which is self-love, self-care. As women in academia, we need to, you know, take care of ourselves first, you know, create time for ourselves, you know, those things. And then, so obviously that makes sense, right? We have to do that. But then the problem becomes when we keep saying no to other people, right? And then yes to ourselves, right? And so we will, like what an easy example would be, like it is actually getting harder and harder. And I've heard this from several editors of like journal or like publisher or whatever, to get a manuscript reviewed, like at a peer, you know, like a journal, academic journal or like publisher, because now people, especially women of color, say no, right? I don't have time to like review that manuscript or, you know, that article, because, you know, I want to protect myself and all of that. So, right, that's good. But at the same time, right, there are only so many of us women of color, right? And if you know, probably in the US, full professors count, women of color who are full professors count only for 6%, right, of full professors in the United States. So there's only so many of us. So what happens is that when there's like book that talk about, you know, women of color or by women of color or about women of color, there are only so many of us and we get asked. But then if many of us keep saying no, 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 then we have these books, right, about women of color or by women of color, don't get reviewed, right? And so in other words, that's why in my book, I talk about this thing called vigilant eco-love as an antidote, or in some ways as an alternative to this self-love culture. Because, you know, how do we then love without abandoning ourselves but also not abandoning others in the process, right? Because I feel the self-love culture, kind of like, you know, we put ourselves first, we love ourselves first, but at the same time, we kind of like abandon others and kind of like leave them on their own. So I think,
I think as well, you get a kind of trickle down effect, don't you? Because, like, you know, I'm a junior academic, yeah. So, and I live on a precarious, in a precarious world. I'm not sort of like, I'm not tenured or anything. So actually what happens is my experience very recently, I'm not going to go into detail, but my very recently, my career almost like, you know, it got a real hit because I had to accommodate someone's holiday. I don't have, you know, I'm like, you know, so self-care, self-love can actually mean trickle down to, you know, it contributes to other people's precarity if we're not careful.
Absolutely. And that's why now I feel, before I say no, I think about the ecology, right? The eco-love, the vigilant eco-love. When I say no to this manuscript, like, you know, what happened to this, right? And so that's what I'm trying to balance. So like, I see the self as part of the ecology. It's not that I abandon myself either, right? It's not to say, okay, forget about self-love. You know, I'm not saying that. I'm talking about vigilant eco-love, but then that the self is part of that ecology, right? Mm. And so how do we really, really kind of like manage and really think about the ecology at the same time we do this? And we can only do this when we talk to each other, right? Yeah, when we talk to each other, when we act as a collective, right? And not just sort of like, okay. And not act as sort of like an individual and just say no, you know, but you know, how do we like talk among ourselves and kind of like, you know, support each other, especially as women of color in academia? Yeah. We really need to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. So you mentioned a word earlier on, and I sort of highlighted it as something I wanted you to talk to me about. What's phantasmagoria? Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Phantasmagoria. And so I remember, I think I get, you know, this was somewhere in Europe. I don't remember exactly. I'm thinking it was in Naples or Napoli in Italy. And I went to these, what do you want to call it? Like, I guess just an art exhibit, just to make it easier. And then there was this kind of like a performance of Phantasmagoria. And this is sort of like, if you remember, like, you know, the magic lantern, and then you'll have this sort of like image shown. And then so you can see, like, and usually this refers to images of like ghosts or like scary movies. But, you know, back in the day, right, before they have, you know, movies and stuff like that. So they have that and they project that onto the screen. And so I kind of like, oh, you know what? This is what entering social media feels to me, right? This sort of like a phantasmagoric kind of like experience where you enter an environment where there's something, you know, the magic lantern, or here I use that as a metaphor for social media, where the social media, or as a magic lantern, they project, right? Yeah. They project certain figures, right? Obviously back then it was the figures of the ghost or scary figures, but now I see what they're projecting, right? Social media as magic lantern, what they're projecting is this neoliberal selfie gaze, right? Like, yeah. You see that. But more than that, what I'm trying to use this metaphor for social media as phantasmagoria is the ways in which social media is both addictive, right? So it's addictive, but it's also affective. Again, going back to that affect theory, right? It's affective, right? And so what's brilliant about social media is that social media is like got us hooked, right? But it got us hooked because of that emotion, right? That affective, right? But again, what is even more genius about social media is that it got us hooked through our emotion, but it does so by simultaneously alienating us, but making us feel at the same time, or making us feel like we still have feeling at the same time, right? So I talk about this more in chapter 2, and I use the word affect alienation to talk about this, right?
Yeah.
So example is that when somebody is posting that they're like having this, like the, the worst breakup of their lives, whatever, like something that's painful, something that's sad. And that makes us feel something, makes us feel sad or whatever feeling, right? Because again, remember, we go to see Phantasmagoria, or we enter Phantasmagoria and we go to social media because we want to feel, right? A lot of my students say, well, you know, I go to social media because I'm bored, right? And so we want to feel something. So we go there and we want to feel something. Now, but so we feel like we feel something, but it actually alienates us from the actual feeling that we're feeling, right? And so when we see other people like post things about how they have like breakup or like certain videos that make us feel sad, we feel that at the same time we're alienated from our own feeling or from our own breakup because we haven't really processed that. Yeah. Right. And the more we spend time on social media, the more time we don't really process our feelings, right? Because we keep scrolling and clicking and clicking and clicking, and we feel like we're feeling something. But the feeling that we're feeling is not exactly our own feeling. It's not our own pain. It's somebody else's pain. And it actually gets us away or distracts us from that feeling that
we have. Process. But also as well, when you talk about phantasmagoria, I'm really struggling with this. Actually, there's a haunting aspect to this.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There's a haunting because some of that social media comes back to get you later. Yeah. Because as you're evolving, as you're kind of going through this like this single-handed evolution of your kind of like neoliberal sort of feminist self, you know, the campaigns of yesteryear that were like, you know, really important to you, then they really can come back to get you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're right on that, because, and not only that, you know, like it's haunting ourselves, it's also haunting other people.
Yeah.
Right. And so I'm talking about here, you know, when we I'm just trying to use like a very like mundane example of, you know, traveling to a certain place and somebody else posts about their traveling to Italy and posting this and whatnot. And the next time we go to Italy, right? I mean, their experience haunt us. In some ways, right? And so this sort of like, you know, the aspect, that affective, you know, experience that we feel when we're on social media, and then when we are actually experiencing this real life, it really haunts us in that way. And this is just traveling, but, you know, talk about other things, about sexual abuse, sexual harassment, and sexual violence, which is what my book is about, right? And so imagine when we think of all of these things, right? And therefore the consequences or the effects are even more devastating or dangerous.
Yeah, I get that. So you describe the book as answering Lisa Lowe's call to open up conversation about the Asian American as an epistemological object. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So there is a ways in which we create Asian American as an object of study, right? And that is absolutely problematic, right? And so, and in certain disciplines, we have to study in this way because of the methods, right? And specific methodology that we have to go through, right? And so by way of looking at social media, right? And looking at these Asian American and Asian Canadian sort of like women, but at the same time, I look at it from their sort of like strategic anti-essentialism, right? And the ways in which that they, so maybe I have to go back, take a step back here by introducing the concept that I talk about in the book, which is called racial oscillation, right? And I talk about how on social media, there is this thing, you know, racial oscillation that happens when either the user or the follower or like the audience or both, right? They're playing around with the context of the posting. What I mean by that is that whether they provide the context or they don't provide the context, or they disregard the context when they read the posting, right? And so something that is actually something about race can be read as not about race, or when something was written as not about race and then get read as about race, right? So they kind of like oscillate, right? So I'm arguing that racial oscillation in my book, it allows us to understand how Asian American in digital technology or on social media become or are like being marginalized without being at the margin, right? So
okay.
Marginalized without being at the margin. And I think this helps us understand, and so this is what I meant by, you know, like how do we change, right? Or we shift how we think about Asian as an object, or like, how do we know what we know about Asian, right? And so that's what I try to challenge here by looking at, well, first of all, you know, like social media and the ways in which the, these Asian American and Asian Canadian women kind of, you know, position themselves, not as a fixed identity, right? But as this sort of like oscillating, right? Racially oscillating subjectivity. That's not necessarily because of them, but also by how what they oppose are being read by others.
Yeah, you call it a methodology of the oppressed. I wonder what you meant by that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I love this sort of like methodology of the oppressed, Chela Sandoval's idea, because I find that here's the thing, right? To live in this world, right, as a colonized, as a marginalized person, and then if we try to, let's just, you know, use our own example as academics, right? There are certain theorists, right, that you have to cite, right? But at the same time, as a marginalized person, these people that you have to cite are often not part of the marginalized group,
yeah,
right? And so Chela Sandoval sort of like talks about, you know, this methodology of the oppressed. You know, how do you live and shift gears? And I love this. And I don't know how many of my students who, you know, because like I when I was in Indonesia, I learned to drive car by like having that stick, right? So I know this sort of like the stick shift, and you change the gears, right? And so she's using that metaphor of like near shifting the stick, right? The gear to understand, or to kind of like, you know, be here to understand, you know, what's going on, you know, and, you know, how to cite, who to cite, and at the same time, not betray our sort of like position. In other words, not let ourselves be co-opted and only cite the big theorist, right? And so we have to shift gears. We have to learn these, you know, people. And if we have to, because sometimes our, you know, committee members, if you are still in grad school, tell you have to cite, you know, so and so, like, you know, a white man or something like that. And then she said, okay, so how do we cite them at the same time challenge what they're writing, right? In other words, so it fulfills that at the same time, we as the oppressed, we have to learn this, you know, how to be in this world at the same time, to live in this world. Mm-hmm.
I'm actually getting this impression of actually shifting up gear. Yeah. And just speeding off. And
leaving
them in the rear view mirror where they belong.
Oh,
the only person with a beard I'm prepared to cite is myself. Anyway.
love that.
Tell me how you conducted the research for this book, because your methodology is quite interesting. So tell us about the methodology you utilize.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do have a section there in my book, and I call this as I mean, it is there, so I'm not creating something new. It's feminist discourse analysis, right? And when we are studying social media, which is expansive, right? I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. So how do you make your data manageable but robust at the same time? So humanities, you know, scholars, again, I didn't make this rule, but they propose, they're like at least two ways to make this possible. One is to follow someone's social media account, which I do with like Rupi Kaur, with Mia Matsumiya, and she has Instagram account called Perv Magnet. Mm-hmm. I also follow Sahara Pirsada's Twitter account. So I follow their account, right? And I just analyze all of what they posted up to a certain point. And I think it was May 3rd, 2019, I believe. And then the other method is to follow a specific hashtag. And so I do that with Margaret Cho's 12 Days of Rage, where I do a search for specifically on Twitter with that specific hashtag 12 Days of Rage. And I analyze all of those that were available to me on a specific date, and I manually logged them. And luckily I had at the time an undergraduate research assistant to help me sort of like manage all of these data for me. And then discourse analysis is looking at patterns, right? And so it's sort of like looking at, you know, sort of like the emerging themes, and each chapter I focus, or like each data obviously tells you different theme, and therefore each chapter sort of like focuses on whatever theme that sort of like pops up from whatever that I was looking at. But what I did differently in chapter where I talk about Margaret Cho's 12 Days of Rage is that I look not only at the pattern of what is being tweeted or being said, but also what is not being said, right? Mm-hmm. So what is silence? So like where silence emerges or like merges in these sort of posts.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. It's really interesting because I I've been reading a lot about social harms, and sometimes the harms are as much about the silence as what's not as what's said, you know. So can you tell us about, you know, the sort of like the women that your book discusses and how you came to choose them? Why did you choose them and who are they? Give the reason.
Yeah, so this is always the trickiest part about, you know, doing sort of like, you know, discourse analysis like this is like, you know, like how do you find example that would allow you to talk about what you're talking about, right? And so in terms of Margaret Cho, it was, as I mentioned, it sort of, you know, like I went to her show and then she was talking about 12 Days of Rage. I was like, wow, like this is sort of like perfect. And obviously there were actually others that didn't make it into the book. Like I wrote it, I finished them, and then it didn't sort of like go with, you know, like the whole sort of like the framing of the book. And I finally used sort of like Ferguson's sort of like way of like organizing, you know, what is neoliberal feminism? And I kind of like look at those sort of like the three themes, liberalization through capitalism, and then, you know, talk about the individualization of persistent gender inequality. So I talk about all of these in my book. And so that's how I came to kind of like, you know, like what would be the best example. So I did a lot of like research looking at, you know, specific social media accounts, and then I analyzed them, you know, just sort of like briefly and see and to get like a the first stage sort of like, okay, like whether this accounts would be good to analyze. And then for Ruby Kaur, I also want to, again, because I follow her and I also kind of like, I analyze her her Instagram account, and it was, you know, amazing. It was great. But again, like I said, you know, there was like something troubling. And so I wanted to have an Instagram account that a lot of people may know about because then it would be easier for them to understand. The same thing with like Margaret Cho as well, as, you know, I feel like she's a prominent figure, you know, the first, most famous, I would say, Korean American woman, sort of like female comedian. And in terms of the Mia Matsumiya's Perv Magnet, I think when she started that account, it was all over media coverage. And so it was on, I believe it was on NBC.com, I think, Washington Post, you know, it was all over. And so what I do usually when I'm like interested in something is when something pops up, I would just file them away in my folder. And I have like I said, like so many different folders that didn't make it into, you know, the end of the book. And I did look at like, you know, like other things, but so this ends up being like the one that, you know, like after, you know, several tries, I was like, okay, so I can work with this.
Yeah, cool. So you tell us that you wrote the book because you did not dare to confront.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? What didn't you want to confront?
Yes. So as I mentioned before, I wanted to write this book because I started seeing that, you know, there's something problematic here when people, you know, activists, my friends, my colleagues, my esteemed colleagues who are like all amazing. And even myself, right? And I was like, you know, why am I doing that? Right? Like, I don't like that, you know? And so when somebody posted something, activists or academics or, you know, people from my own communities of practice, posting something from a neoliberal selfie gaze is very problematic, right? But I didn't want to confront them, you know, how people are like, you know, doing this, the call out culture or like the cancel culture, right? And then, or troll them, right? Say mean things about certain things. And as I mentioned before, I tend to be more quiet or shy or whatever. And if I know that person, then, you know, you still have that sort of like boundary, I think, like, you know, that person. And so you would know what kind of reaction they will have. And so I'm not a believer. I shouldn't say I'm a believer. That's not the right word. I don't know why I said that, but I'm not a big, you know, like confrontational kind of like person anyway. Like, I mean, in real life, you know, I try to either just, you know, do something else or something, but I try not to confront, you know, like we can talk about it later or something like that, but it's just sort of like, I don't tend to confront. And so, because I think, and so I said in my book that instead of like confront them online, I hope that they will read my book and they can see with evidence, right? With evidence, like what I mean by neoliberal selfie gaze and how they and I too, project and perform this neoliberal selfie gaze. Because sometimes even, you know, even not about my book, right? Let's say someone said something that's racist or sexist or heterosexist. Many, many times, I mean, I've done this before where I, you know, called them out on that and whatever. And it ends up being a lot of the time not productive. Because I feel that in my own class, you know, in my own classrooms, it takes me a semester, right? A semester and a lot of books, a lot of readings for them to actually say at the end of the class, they do actually say things like, you know, in the beginning of semester, I thought like this, and then now I think like this, right? But it takes a semester, right? It takes time. It takes this sort of like, you read this and then you read this because you've read that. And then you know, it's an engagement, right? It's a dialogue and then you get there. So I feel that on social media, we actually don't have that space.
No.
And then if they never read this, they don't understand that, you know, they don't have that space and time to actually learn about each other. Then it's just, you know, like people just like fighting, and then you're just trying to prove yourself right, or you're just trying to defend yourself. And I talk about that in my book too, you know, like what do we do when we are being called out, right? Because right now people seem to be like, you know, like quick to call out on somebody's behavior, but then when the person apologizes, they don't even care because it's like they did this. But hey, look, we're all in this, you know, obviously different in different ways. Some people are, yes, way, way more racist than others, right? And they need to stop that. And we need to have like that conversation, right? But if we provide no space for people to make mistakes, right? And to like correct that behavior, if we don't think about the ecology, if we only think about ourselves, we're only think about like projecting the best version of ourselves, well, then, you know, you're still being or performing that neoliberal selfie gaze rather than anything.
That's so interesting. I just got so much from that because I was just thinking, maybe that's entirely what this is about. It's the fact that you can never have that kind of joined up, continuous conversation just mm-hmm. by virtue of the fact, say, for example, Twitter, I don't know how many characters it is nowadays, but you can't have a conversation with 56 characters, can you? And it's the same way with Instagram. You can't have a conversation just entirely just throwing images at each other. So it looks like it's actually communicating, but actually it's not communicating at all, is it? It's just like making lots of like separate statements that don't join up.
Yeah, so, and I'm also trying, and I hope it's clear also in my book that's why I feel that it's important to have that the fifth chapter, the final chapter, that, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, everything on social media is bad, that everything on social media will be neoliberalized, right? And so I'm saying that, you know, there are ways to do this. There are ways to do this with social media. Here's one example of how we can do that, right? But it is certain that we can only, if we are to only use social media for our feminist activism, then nothing will really get changed, because we need to look at different elements in that ecology. And digital environment is only one environment. I mean, right, one element in that environment, right? And so we have to look at the physical, we have to look at the spiritual, we have to look at the emotional, we have to look at all these other things, right? The issue of law, the issue of this, like all of these like things that are happening at the same time, we have to, you know, mindfully look at all of these things. Maybe one person cannot do all of that things, right? That's why we need the collective, right? We need our togetherness, right? To go there. And so I think that's what I hope that I convey a little bit in this book is, you know, let's not just, you know, ban or like, let's not like forget about social media. It is useful. It is useful for certain things. It is useful in certain ways, even by changing the hashtag, like you said, you know, stop sexism, stop, you know, sexual harassment or stop, right? Rather than focusing on us, you know, like what would be, you know, let's come up with a better hashtag, right? To highlight the structure, to highlight the ideological, right? Rather than just, you know, it's about me, it's about me, it's about me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, you like, I've just got a few more things that I wanted to ask. You discussed the stigmatization of silence.
Absolutely.
Can you expand on that a little bit? Because it seems to me that silence is, you know, is as important in these discussions. Who's not there is as important who's there, because let's be honest, quite often when people are posting, it's because they're trying to attract an audience, and when that audience doesn't come, it's quite interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So here I also want to talk about silence particularly as a technology of testimony, right? In other words, silence is an apparatus of testimony. So that's why I came up with the term silence as testimony, right? And how on social media, silence, when performed collectively, can actually function as a testimony, right? So what I am saying is not that we should be silent or like we should not say anything, right? But social media is good for something, right? So if we can perform this, you know, silence through the hashtag silence as testimony. In other words, you have to mark it, like you mark that silence as something. And when people mention that, when people use that hashtag, silence as testimony, silence as testimony, then it makes people think, why are they being silent, right? Why are they not saying anything? And I feel this, especially during the Me Too movement, right? I mean, the Me Too hashtag, when they went viral, I too, obviously, or me too, I guess, have experienced that, right? But I wasn't ready to share that on social media. And I do feel that some people, when they do share that, that they're being trolled for things that they were saying. In other words, the Twitter or like social media itself may not be a safe space for us, right? And I want us to highlight this, right? I want us to say, well, I am silent because of the structure that is not safe for us to speak. Right. And so we need to highlight that. We need to pay attention to that. We need to mark it. And on social media, we're able to hashtag it. We are able to say something about it. We're able to say something with our silence. Yeah. So that's what I meant. And so I even offer this, you know, notion of silence as testimony as a way for us to rethink feminist, you know, agency, right? Because feminist agency is often sort of described as, you know, you have to speak up. You have to break the silence, right? Break the silence, right? But again, here, I want us to rethink with silence, about silence, so that silence can also be part of the repertoire of this feminist agency.
Don't feed the bears, basically.
Yeah.
So who did you write this book for? Who was your target audience?
Absolutely. So this book is obviously academic, and there's like some theories in it. And so my primary audience will be women's studies scholars and students. But also, I hope that I've done, you know, a good enough job of explaining things, explaining theories in a clear enough way so that this can also be used for people who are not or non-academics, right? And so obviously feminist activists, I would love it so much if they would be able to engage with this book. And again, not so much about, you know, kind of like changing their behavior to the way that I suggested in chapter 5, because again, like I said, chapter 5 is just a proposal of like, here's one thing that you can do, right? I'm not trying to say this is how to do it. This is not about that at all. But for them to think other ways to make their practice more progressive, right? So it's an invitation for feminist activists to read this book and to, you know, take their social media practice to the next level. Yeah. But also I think for people who are on social media, I think they should read this book, right? It allows them to think, you know, how to be on social media, you know, more mindfully and more aware of how their presence are being maybe co-opted by these competing or cooperating ideologies, right? So I think it's good to have that.
And I think you captivate that really well with the Lord's quote about, you know, you can't use the master's tools to dismantle the master's hat. Yeah. We've got to be aware of what we're using. What looks like this gift of communication may not be the kind of gift that we think it is. So, yeah, finally, what comes next? What have you got in the pipeline?
Yeah, so I have written another book and it is currently under review. So I'm keeping all my fingers and toes and everything else crossed. It is about me traveling to 20 countries in 1 year and how I use that experience to think about pain and what it means to live with pain, as you know, or like what it means to have this pain, you know, and have sort of like a feminist life, right? Or pain as a feminist life, right? And so Gloria Anzaldúa sort of like say that. So I'm just sort of like, you know, expanding on her brilliance here, in terms of, you know, if feminist theory is useful, right? How does it useful for us to think about pain differently? So I think that's next. And so obviously, as you can tell, this book, also the book that we're talking about today has that word pain in it as well, pain generation. So I guess I'm just into pain these days.
So chance for shameless plug here. Who are you? What's the name of the book and who publishes it?
Absolutely. So I am Ayu Saraswati, an associate professor at the University of Hawaii. And my book is called Pain Generation, Social Media, Feminist Activism, and the Neoliberal Selfie by NYU Press.
Excellent. My name is Rachel Stewart. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Kent.